ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Online, it feels like the answer is always yes. Yes to cookies, yes to tracking, yes to data sharing. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I find out what happens when you finally say no. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show, ABC Radio National. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. It's summer on ABC Radio National, so I'm bringing you some of your favourite stories from the past year. And today, I'm giving you a peek behind the curtain of secretive, extremist subcultures. They're in our backyards, but most of us don't know much about them. Coming up, you'll hear from a journalist who delved down the rabbit hole to the history of conspiracy theories in Australia and why so many take root among seemingly ordinary Aussies. You'll also hear about tradwife subculture, and I'll speak to a young mum who says the movement has been co-opted by alt-right radicals. But first, if you're a parent, it's hard to imagine your child drifting away from you, not just emotionally, but into dangerous territory. In Australia, some young people are being drawn into online spaces where hate is normalised, spaces that can radicalise them into extremist views or even violent ideologies. And this recruitment doesn't happen in far-off places. It's happening in bedrooms, behind closed doors, through screens, often without parents knowing until it's too late. Last year, ASIO raised the national terror threat level to probable, meaning an attack or attempt is more likely than not in the near future. And a key concern is young men radicalised online, some as young as 12, targeting others because of their gender, background or beliefs. But getting early help can be incredibly hard. You're about to hear from a woman whose work involves pulling people back from the brink of extremism. Peter Lowe is a social worker and former director of Countering Violent Extremism for Juvenile Justice. She's here to share what families can do and why early intervention matters. Peter, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you so much for having me.
Peter, how prevalent is radicalisation among Australians?
I think we have to be careful when we talk about radicalisation. It's just the process of forming a belief that's outside of normal. What we're most concerned about is when young people are moving towards beliefs that involve violent or violent extremist ideologies in particular. And we've definitely seen an increase in the number of young people being identified as moving towards violent extremist ideologies.
Broad words, is it possible to talk about what kind of ideologies you're seeing in your work?
Yeah, I mean, it's really challenging at the moment because the spectrum has widened quite a deal from where we were maybe even 10 years ago looking at particularly religious extremist ideologies. We're now seeing a lot more political ideologies, so lots of far-right extremism. We're seeing a lot of anti-establishment ideologies, and that's certainly come as a result of a lot of the COVID lockdowns, so mis and distrust in governments and government having a lack of legitimacy. And then we've seen an increase in what people are calling the manosphere, or these sorts of ideologies that are based on gender and gender-based violence.
So you say in your work that Australia has fallen behind in picking up on these trends. How has that happened?
Look, I think that there's a number of things that have occurred. I think we've been very successful in this country in our disruptions. So our law enforcement and intelligence agencies have been able to disrupt quite a lot of extremist activity and terrorist groups. And that has meant then that the focus has been on security and making sure that we can disrupt and detect. And therefore, we've lost the focus on, from my opinion, what's truly important, and that's the early intervention that means no one gets to the point that they need to be disrupted.
Who are these groups that are targeting people? What are their motivations?
Look, that's very broad. There's a large number of groups, and it really depends on the group's ideologies, so what the group believes. Some of them are violent extremist groups. Some of them are groups that are just looking to destabilise, and that means that you may not have an ideological belief as such, but they might just want to destabilise communities. They may want to destabilise governments and societies. And some of that, there's a lot of criminal activity now, so criminal enterprises that are engaged in furthering extremist ideology, because what it does is it causes communities to distrust others.
Someone's texted in saying, what are the warning signs?
That's such a great question. It's really challenging with young people because the warning signs are really change. So someone changing the way that they dress, changing the things that they might be interested in talking about, which we would expect our young people to be doing. This is the time when they're forming their beliefs. So, of course, a lot of young people are changing those things. But what really becomes concerning is when they refuse to engage in conversations about particular beliefs, whether that's political beliefs or gender-based beliefs or religious beliefs, or worse, that they can become extremely agitated or aggressive if you start to engage them in a conversation about something. And so this starts to show that they're starting to form quite rigid beliefs, and that can be concerning for young people. So changing things is something we would want to talk to our young people about. We'd want to understand why they might be dressing different, why they might be hanging out with different people, why they might be using different language or interested in different topics. That's all normal adolescent behaviour. But if you're having conversations with young people and they are refusing to engage in particular topics, or they're starting to become really aggressive or try and force you to believe something, or becoming actually even verbally aggressive about a topic, that would be something that you would really want to seek some advice about.
When we're having conversations like this, the stereotype does seem to be young men. Is that accurate? And if it is, what is it about that group that puts them at particular risk?
Yeah, so I think in terms of a stereotype, it's probably unhelpful. I mean, anyone can be radicalised. Anyone can move through that process of forming radical beliefs at any age and any gender, depending on, you know, certain factors within them and within the environment around them. We are noticing young men in particular. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that. There's a very big movement at the moment about male identity and men's identity, and this is being run, you know, through a lot of Andrew Tate and that sort of environment around Andrew Tate, talking about what is it like to be a young man, which can be very polarizing for men, young men in particular, in communities today. And also we know that for a very long time, young men have been quite susceptible to impulsive behaviour, to not really thinking through their decisions very well. They're much more likely to be risk takers, which means that they're also much more valuable to these groups. So they're targeted more because they might be someone that we can not only get to believe something different very quickly, but we can get them to act on it quite quickly. And so that becomes very valuable to an extremist group.
Peter, someone's text is saying, is there also far left radicalisation happening?
Absolutely, yes. And this is one of the things about radical ideologies, is that we don't ever see a shift on just one side of that spectrum. It influences across the spectrum, and that's across religious ideologies, political ideologies. An ideology is just a set of beliefs. And yes, the far left is very involved. I mean, Antifa has been creating a lot of polarisation in communities, especially post-COVID for some time. And so they are involved, but sometimes not as overtly. They tend to be more covert than some of the other groups.
So it's anti-fascist, sort of a left-wing political movement, especially in the States. Peter, your job is to sit across the table from people who are being or are at risk of being radicalised. How do you get to that table with that person? Who's calling you there?
Look, to be honest, most of the time it's families or other groups who are involved who might contact me to say, look, we're really worried about this particular young person, or I have families contact me directly sometimes to say, I'm really worried and I don't know where else to go. I often get involved at the request of government agencies. So, they might be working with someone and require a little bit of advice or support on a specific matter. And most of the work then here in Australia is also for the court. So I do quite a lot of work in terms of writing reports for courts for different people. So there's a whole range of avenues that I might come into contact with someone. I guess once I'm at the table, my process is pretty standard and pretty similar. I really just want to understand that person's journey and all the things about that journey that have been important to them or good for them. Because often when I engage with someone, there's already all these processes that have happened along the way, and no one's really trying to understand how did we get here. They're just trying to understand, like, what do we do now we're here. And so I think one of the really important things that I would say to people is having some confidence to have a conversation, to just ask about things and to genuinely inquire into why young people might be feeling a certain way, why they might be thinking a certain way. And sometimes those conversations can be critically important for young people who are just at the beginning of this journey, because it starts to help them think through maybe the information that they've been bombarded with, particularly in an online space.
But I'm guessing that one conversation doesn't unpick a whole process here.
Sometimes it can. I mean, our beliefs are one of those things that are very interesting. Yes, some of them can be quite rigid and quite can stay with us, and they can change quite quickly as well. So it can be one conversation, and sometimes it doesn't have to be anything particularly spectacular about that conversation, but just something that makes an individual think differently about information or question the information that they've been given. One of the things that extremist groups do very well is create certainty. This is definitely the way the world operates. Those people are definitely bad and we're definitely good. So by inviting people to just think about that, and does that necessarily always reflect as true? The majority of people who leave extremist, violent extremist groups or terrorist groups, for example, leave because they become totally disillusioned. So what they thought they were getting involved in is not what it ends up being. The reality is quite different. And so often it's trying to find that, well, is this really something that you value and believe in as a person, or have you been told that you should value and believe it? And so I'm always looking for those sorts of differences, I guess, in what someone's telling me versus what I can see from their behaviour. So sometimes it can be as simple as a question that invites someone to think about it. And we have to be careful with this, because when we're questioning the way someone believes things, we're not trying to tell them we're right or wrong, we're trying to understand it. But if I have to explain to you why I believe in something, I really have to think about it as opposed to just defend my position. And that can be an opportunity for someone to really reflect on, wow, maybe I don't actually believe this, or that doesn't fit with other beliefs that I have. So I'm not trying to change people's views. We're just trying to ask them about them, and that can then help them change them for themselves.
So rather than getting into an argument space, you're getting into an explaining space.
Absolutely. I'm interested why you believe that. Yes.
Really interesting question on the text line, Peter. Alison asks, when is anti-fascism an unwelcome ideology, in inverted commas? When is anti-establishment thinking, quote-unquote, extremism?
It's a really great question. So extremism, it happens all the time. There are very extreme beliefs. I mean, and there are extreme beliefs across the spectrum. So extremism is not the problem. And it's a great question, because anti-establishment or anti-government are questions that I think critically thinking, you know, we would want in our society someone to be raising some of those questions. The problem with any of these ideologies, and that goes across the spectrum from religious to political to otherwise, is when they advocate or justify the use of violence to bring about change. So if they're saying that we need to take down the government through violent means, and that's the only way that we are going to be able to rescue people or save people from the peril that they're currently living in, that to me is when it crosses the line between being something that might be helpful and useful and allow us to think more critically, and something that causes harm to communities, harm to individuals, and harm to us as a society. So it's when it begins to advocate, justify, support the use of violence to bring about that change, that's when we as a community should be saying that's not acceptable.
This is Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and I'm talking to Peter Lowe, who is an expert on extremist groups and radicalisation. One person says, it's not only young people. My 71-year-old sister is addicted to YouTube. She believes all the lies being put forward on that medium, and for a year now, we've noticed she refuses to see or believe another point of view. She says it's just a matter of time before mainstream media says the same. This person says, we're not worried she'll act out, but she'd become unstable in her thinking and is now more secretive on her views because we disagree. Peter, any advice for people who, for that person or someone who's hearing that story and going, oh yes, that's someone I know and love as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such a great point. I mean, radicalisation to extremism can happen at any age. The focus at the moment on young people is because we're recognising that they mobilise to act a lot quicker. But you're right, it still has harm. It has harm on, it sounds like, this woman and her relationships with her family. My advice would be, as I said before, you're not going to convince someone that their beliefs are wrong, but by opening up avenues to have conversations that don't end in arguments, that individual may start to think about the way that they believe something. And isolating someone is a way of radicalizing them further. So we don't want them isolated. We actually want them to feel like they can have that conversation, even though we disagree. I have conversations a lot with people who I fundamentally don't agree with their views. However, I do it in a way that I'm still interested to understand why they do. So I'm asking them a lot of the time, like, what does that mean to you? And why, you know, why do you think that's important? And how does this reflect with your other values? And but I'm curious and I'm genuinely interested to understand that perspective, because that helps me understand them a little better, but it helps them understand them a little better. So I would say don't shut those conversations down. I remember when I was younger, my grandmother used to tell me, you know, never have conversations about politics or religion. And now it's all I do. Because I think we shut those conversations down sometimes because there's a variety of perspectives. What we should really be doing is being curious and interested about those other perspectives. And that provides those people who sometimes feel like, I can't have this conversation because someone's always yelling at me or disagreeing with me, which no one wants to be yelled at or disagreed with all the time, as opposed to, well, someone's actually asking me what I think and I can talk to them about it. And that person might be able to reflect back, well, that's interesting, because when I see you do this, that's not the same. So it gives an opportunity for conversation. But if we shut things down and people go online, they are only getting more of the same. There's no opportunity for that additional conversation. So I guess it's challenging. And obviously, if you're concerned that someone is aggressive or violent or has the potential to be aggressive or violent to themselves or others, then that is something that you would seek support and help with. But other than that, I think what we really need to be starting to do as a community is get more curious about why people have these different beliefs.
So if you're a parent or just someone who loves someone who sort of feels like they're not sure about how their loved one is, what their belief system is evolving, you're concerned, what should your first step be? Where can you get help?
That's a really great question, and it's a really concerning one in this country, because, I mean, really your options are to call government-led programs. So in New South Wales, there's a program called Step Together, which offer, you know, online sort of support and telephone support. You know, I've worked with a number of families who that has not been a very good option for them. They've either had no contact back from that service, or they've been told they'll get in touch with them at some point, but no real support in the interim. I notice in the latest in the national counterterrorism strategy, which was released earlier this year, they're saying that they're going to roll that Step Together program out nationally. I don't know what that looks like in terms of, will there actually be case support then for people? Will you actually be able to get advice and help? But also, I mean, a lot of that program works with individuals. And if we're working with young people and children, then we should actually be working with families. So it should be a family support program. There isn't really anywhere at the moment you can go as a family member to say, I just want to get some advice and some help and support to know what to do about this, rather than to actually just report this to some organisation who might take this up. And so that's a real gap that we're trying to resolve in this country at the moment. And we're looking at starting something ourselves to provide support to family members, because there is a real gap of other service delivery out there. And that is the first point of call for me. It's like, if we can engage with family and friends around that individual and provide support to them, then we can do this in a really systemic and sustainable way for community, so that in an ongoing manner, we're not necessarily relying on law enforcement all the time.
Watch this space. Peter, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for your time.
Peter Lowe is a social worker and former director of Countering Violent Extremism for Juvenile Justice. She works with de-radicalising victims of extremism. Coming up next, a peek behind the tradwife subculture.
Christopher Skase. Remember that name? The guy of corporate Australia in the 1980s?
Skase had an aura of success.
He came with that cowboy energy.
He owned resorts, TV stations, a footy team. Skase was on top of the business world. Until he wasn't.
Everything he built up, he lost.
The whole empire was built on debt.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dad out working, mum at home with the kids. It's a stereotypical family dynamic that a lot of us will have grown up with. And alongside that stereotype, generations of women have fought and struggled to make a life and an identity outside the home. But now, some young women are choosing to quit work and revert to more traditional gender and familial roles. On social media and in pop culture, they're called traditional wives or trad wives, and they are huge on social media. Homegrown veggies and flour-dusted pie tins. I mean, let's be real, they're frankly quite photogenic. And like so many big things online, the big hitters in this trend are from the US. And the subcultures become associated with not just kids' craft and freshly churned butter, but far-right ideals. So are trad wives throwing away decades of feminist progress? How did a lifestyle that we used to identify as hippie-ish veer right-wing? And what is the trend telling us about the pressures modern young families face? You're about to hear from an academic who has spent years looking into the tradwife subculture and its influence in America. But first, meet Stacey Knight. She's an Aussie, self-identified tradwife, and she says she just enjoys simplicity and being a homemaker. Stacey, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So you're a stay-at-home mum of two toddlers and you're blogging about your family life online. What does tradwife mean to you?
Tradwife definitely doesn't mean to me the same sort of associated terms and views as it does in America or as some women, I guess, sort of follow over there. It's definitely a different view. I have just a genuine interest in caring for my family, cooking, gardening, and just sort of a simpler way of life.
So tell me about like an average day, what that looks like for you.
An average day, we still do all the normal things a family would. We go out, go to the playground, but we do have a large veggie garden and some chickens. So we like to tend to that at home and make as much food as we can.
Is this something that you've always lived like, or is it something you've come to in more recent years?
No, I was a registered nurse before I had kids. By the time I had my daughter, I sort of leaned more into it and became a full-time stay-at-home mum. I think it's definitely got an aspect of, you know, you can save money gardening, growing your own food and cooking meals from scratch, and obviously the health aspect of it as well.
So you say that you don't align yourself so much with the political, I guess, it's not, you can't say that every trad wife in America has a far-right politics, but there's certainly a synergy there. Why do you choose to use this word when it does have those connotations at the moment?
I probably don't heavily align myself with the word trad wife in specific. I definitely align myself more with the term homemaker and homemaking, but you in that category just automatically get slotted into a trad wife. I definitely do obviously all the traditional roles of a trad wife, cooking, you know, cleaning, but every stay-at-home mum would be doing that as well.
So a lot of the life, or the way it's portrayed online at least, I love this content. I get a lot of it on my own social media feeds and it looks so simple, but is it really that simple if you have to film it all and edit those videos and upload them to the internet?
Look, if you weren't videoing it and editing it, that definitely adds, you know, the aspect of making it a lot harder and taking more time. But it definitely also gives you a bit of motivation, you know, to get your garden looking nice and growing more food and helping others, I guess, if they want to learn how to do it as well. So it definitely adds time, but I think in the sense of it still making or going back to just like a simple way of life, yes, I do think it is. It's obviously a little work as well. I mean, you don't just grow a garden and, you know, tend for animals.
Yeah, those veggies certainly don't just pop out of the ground by themselves. No. I know that from my own experience. Yeah. You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor and I'm speaking to Stacey Knight, who sometimes describes herself as a trad wife, but not like that. On the text line, someone says, I can understand the appeal of a simpler life, but I think the commercialization of an ideal model of female servitude is very dangerous. A more holistic way of life should involve a change to both men and women's traditional roles. Stacey, talk to me about how you see the lifestyle that you and your partner have chosen together in your family and how that sits against the erosions of the rights and freedoms women have fought for over the years?
Well, I think women fought for choice, and that's in today's society, my choice to stay at home and care for my kids and garden and cook. So I think everyone gets that confused. They didn't fight just to go to work. They fought for the choice of being able to choose. And, you know, people don't ask men why they stay home or why they do things. They only seem to ask the women.
Hmm. Such a good point. I'd love to turn to Dr. Christy Campion, who's an academic at Charles Sturt University, and her research has been very much about the tradwife subculture and its influence in America. Christy, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So we've just heard Stacey's story, which is quite a specific and Australian story, but you've been looking at this culture at large in the States. How do you describe a tradwife in your research sphere?
Look, I see the concept of the tradwife as an umbrella term that captures within it quite a number of different sorts of people and different sorts of beliefs as well. So the tradwife phenomena, it's not just a right-wing notion. It also exists in the left-wing. It exists in religious spaces and in non-political spaces as well. My research, however, has generally looked quite closely at tradwives within the far right.
So tell me about what you're seeing in the States and why we're seeing this uprising of conservative values being associated with this movement.
Yeah, look, so it is one of those movements that's really difficult to quantitate. How much is it actually growing? What is actually appealing to people? And to all, you know, anyone who becomes a tradwife or enters into that world, there are a wide array of motivations that can impact that. But generally speaking, what's particularly compelling about this this way of living is it draws on an extremely popular social media aesthetic. You know, it draws on cottage core, it draws on the soft girl notion. It draws on this idea that being a trad wife is a simpler and purer way of living. But in the far right, we see that with direct connotations with white womanhood and womanhood under threat. And they really are capable of twisting it into, into almost an anti-feminist stance.
Lots of people texting in. Some say, one person says, I think women are being drawn to it due to an added pressure of modern life for women now. Women with full-time jobs still come home and do the bulk of the cooking, cleaning and housework. We are tired. Another person says staying at home with your kids has become aspirational because it's just so out of reach for so many families who require a dual income just to survive. Christy, how much is this cost of living and huge juggle play into the attraction of this, especially online?
Look, I think your commenters are absolutely spot on there. This is actually something that we see far-right tradwives talk about a lot, which is that they talk about modern society as being in decay. And one of the reasons why they say that is because cost of living is so dire right now that many women don't actually have the choice of staying home with their children. They're being, some women are feeling like they're being forced into the workforce in addition to continuing to carry the broader weight of domestic duties and domestic labour. And so this is what we actually see far-right tradwives talk about, and they talk about modern society as crushing women, as defeminising women, and forcing them into unnatural ways of living. So those sorts of narratives do actually play into the popularity of the movement. One of the tricky aspects of it, though, is that for many people, being a tradwife is not their economic reality because they simply can't afford it. So it becomes more of a individualist fantasy or an escape, the idea of leaving the workforce and becoming a tradwife. When we see this being sort of promoted, though, by the far right, they're not thinking of it from the perspective of women's welfare or women's ability to choose. They're thinking of it from the perspective of countering what they see as the influence of left-wing politics. They're seeing it from the perspective of modern society being controlled by feminism or left-wing politics. And then they're able to sort of weave into it all these other narratives that are actually quite abusive narratives towards members of our community. So these are narratives against the LGBTIQ community, against immigrant communities, but we also see them fiercely opposing things like abortion or divorce.
Christy, so your research is very much focused on the States. I'd love to know how much we know about how those views are reflected here in Australia.
Look, some of them are amongst a very small subculture of far-right trad wives in Australia, because, again, not every trad wife is far-right, but there does tend to be quite a lot of online connection between these communities. You know, it's 2025, we're all talking to people online every day, so that's not a terribly surprising thing. But we do tend to see in this space, these sorts of influences often do collaborate and share content and really broaden their reach across international boundaries.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and we're talking about tradwives this morning, going back to a so-called traditional way of life, especially as it's represented to us online. One person says, feminism is 100% about choice and freedom and equality. It's not about telling people how to live, which is really the point that Stacey Knight made before. She's a tradwife, sometimes self-described tradwife here in Australia, very separate to the research that Christy does. Stacey, I'd love to bring you back into the conversation because we have a lot of people asking questions about your experience. Someone says, please ask Stacey about the realities of blogging and internet presence. What's that like, displaying your lifestyle online for everyone to sort of see and comment on?
Well, I mean, I have quite a small following. I also don't commonly share my kids on social media. I just try to stick to gardening and recipes and meal prep and snack prep and things like that. So you do get the odd comments, but I've actually been pretty lucky. I don't really get that many bad comments other than the feedback sometimes about how I cook a steak.
Everyone's got their own opinions on how to cook steak. Another text here says, highly recommend the trad husband. My husband took on the homemaking role while I worked. He did a great job and we saved a heap of money with his fixing and repairing skills. Stacey, if you're sort of filling the very traditional wife role in your household, what's your husband's contribution?
Well, he obviously contributes financially and he is still a very hands-on dad. I still get to do, you know, all of my own things, have my own time, as does he. So we still are a very modern couple, but we just are in the traditional sense that he goes to work and I stay home with the kids. But there's still a lot of support, open communication and equal rights, which I think is the most important part.
So your kids are still pretty little. Do you see yourself going back into the workplace at some stage?
I don't see myself going back anytime soon. I think I might rethink it when they go to school. But as some of the commenters said when they texted in, I do agree that for working mums, it would be really hard to juggle mum life. Even though you could have the most supportive husband in the world, very hands-on, you still have the mental load of being a mother, and that just doesn't go away. So I think I'm privileged enough to stay home, and I think it would be really hard to go to work full-time and also look after the kids.
I can hear some very cute little cooing noises in the background, Stacey. I'll let you get back to your day as a mum. That was Aussie tradwife Stacey Knight. She said she doesn't identify with the politics of the world but was drawn to the simple life, which she blogs about online, her family life, veggie gardens and home cooking. And earlier you heard from Dr. Christy Campion. She's an academic at Charles Sturt University who's investigated the tradwife subculture, largely its influence in the US. But next year on Life Matters, we're going down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theories in Australia. Think for yourself. While it's still legal, there's microchips in your vaccine. Birds aren't real. Maybe you've had an uncle, a sister, a parent start talking like this and red flags went straight up. Conspiratorial thinking has spread through the megaphone of the internet and Australians aren't immune. These theories take on a unique flavour here in Australia. But what is it about our society in particular which lets these beliefs take root? To help answer this question, I'm joined by Ariel Bogle. She's the co-author of Conspiracy Nation, Exposing the Dangerous World of Australian Conspiracy Theories. Ariel, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Tegan. Good to be here.
Was there a particular conspiracy theory that got you thinking about writing this book?
Well, both my co-author, Cam Wilson, and I had kind of been in this mix during the pandemic. We'd been covering kind of the false claims that were circulating about the virus. We had been covering the anti-lockdown movement that sprung up in that era, looking at the anti-vaccine movement as well. And it was early 2023, we were sort of reflecting on that time. And I think what really struck me was that we often think of Australia as just kind of a net importer of conspiracy theories, just receiving all these claims from the United States by and large. But we thought there was something unique happening here too, something that hadn't really been examined about what exactly took off here in Australia, which conspiracy theories are kind of adapt to our home ground, which ones are we creating for ourselves, and what kind of stories are we telling about the lives of people in this country.
Tell me about some of the Aussie conspiracy theories you looked into.
Well, we looked into Port Arthur, of course, the mass shooting, the tragic mass shooting back in 1996. We think that's kind of a central text, I guess, of the Australian conspiracy theory culture, because it really took off just as the internet was entering the homes of Australians. Mm. So, you know, it happened in 1996 and people on the ground, journalists, others who were there, didn't really start to hear these fake claims about what had happened that day spread until the late 90s and the early 2000s, when people suddenly had access to the internet in their home. And you can kind of trace that through YouTube comment sections, you know, things were traveling through old GeoCity type blogs. It started to spread from there. And now in our experience, when we're wading into these subcultures, both in real life at protests and rallies and things, but also on the internet, of course, we see these fake claims about Port Arthur as kind of a central thread in that culture.
I mean, conspiracy theories aren't new, but it's talk to me about what it is about the nature of the internet that's really supercharged them.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. You know, people do make the claim that the internet has made more people believe in conspiracy theories, and we question that. I mean, I also question the sort of term believe. What does it really mean when people say they believe in a conspiracy theory? Because if we're honest with ourselves, like, we all dabble in these ideas. They can be kind of fun, like the claim that, you know, Harold Holt was picked up by a Soviet submarine and spirited away, or, you know, that Farlap was killed by American gangsters. These aren't stories that, you know, raise red flags immediately. They're just kind of fun things to dabble with. And we see this on the internet all the time. You know, these are kind of fairy tales we can sort of participate in with each other as some form of entertainment. But there is a spectrum here. I think when stories about, you know, evildoers plotting against the common good, you know, despite all evidence to the contrary, start to circulate, they are fulfilling some sort of need for people, whether it is putting a simple story around a really complicated situation, which is what we saw during the pandemic, or in the worst instances, I think too, we need to acknowledge that they can just be simply cover for our worst instincts, whether it be racism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, of course. So this all permeates on the internet just like it does in real life. But I think what the internet does is just make it easier for people who believe in these things, or, you know, are looking for these kinds of stories, to find each other, and they can kind of self-seal in these ideological ecosystems because the internet allows them to communicate so much more easily than things did in the past.
I kind of rattled off a list of conspiracy theories at the beginning there, and almost flippantly, and I wonder whether actually that is the right tone to take with this sort of conversation, because if feeling disenfranchised is a predictor of people being drawn to ideas like this, does kind of making fun of them or being flippant about them maybe make people feel even more alienated?
It's a good question, and I think it's definitely something we discussed a lot in deciding what approach to take with the book. And we definitely approach people that we talk to who believe in these ideas, who are struggling with things in their lives and have turned to these ideas in a moment of crisis. We hope we treated them with empathy and trying to understand what purpose these ideas serve for them. But of course, we do want to take a more critical eye when people are exploiting these ideas. So whether that be to make money off fake health claims or using these for political purposes, because as we trace in the book too, these conspiratorial tropes, here are the good guys and here are the evil bad guys. Like, it's such a simple framework that makes it a really useful one for politics. And unfortunately, we have seen kind of conspiratorial frameworks turn up in Australian Parliament too. So, you know, there's a lot of people that want to traffic in these ideas for their own power as well.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Ariel Bogle, who is the co-author of Conspiracy Nation, all about Australian-grown conspiracy theories. Greg says, a friend of mine recently became unemployed. Unfortunately, to fill in time, he started Googling and got into crop circles, chemtrails, the big government controlling us conspiracies. Greg says, at least now he's busy with an online course and so has less time to, in inverted commas, research these things. Ariel, as part of your research for the story, you spoke with people who had been involved in conspiracy theories and had let go of them. What did they tell you?
Well, we did want to look at like how to push back against these ideas and talk to people that might have like been in one side and come out the other. And certainly there was like no simple 1-2-3 step plan. So unfortunately, I don't have that to offer your listeners. But I think it's really when... Well, I suppose I'll take one example. I spoke to a psychologist who had some clients during the pandemic started to share with him ideas like QAnon. People might be familiar. This is this extremely significant conspiracy theory in the United States that Donald Trump was fighting a elite pedophile cabal and would sweep it all away, you know, with elements of, you know, arresting Hillary Clinton and all of Hollywood. And, you know, it just got bigger and bigger. And also some anti-vaccine sentiment that they were sharing with him. And he really did struggle with how to approach that with his clients, whether they could still do the work of therapy together. And he decided, you know, he wasn't going to let these clients go because when he really got down to it, he wanted to try and understand why they had turned to these ideas, what needs they were serving. And in one instance, he had a client who had been, you know, had a workplace injury, was struggling to find help and sort of deal with the end of a potential career that he had dreamed about for a long time. And maybe these ideas had helped, or he turned to these ideas in that moment of crisis. But when he was able to get the help that he needed, these ideas were less pertinent for him. He didn't need them as much and started to turn away from them. And that's what other researchers in this space have told me. Matt Marks, an Australian academic who studies these ideas as well, said, you know, there's not like really a cult dusting approach you can take, but often when the material circumstances change that had led people to these ideas, that can help resolve. So, you know, maybe it is really at the biggest level, looking at equity in Australia, access to resources, access to healthcare. These are the types of things we should be talking about when trying to ensure that people don't spin off down the rabbit hole.
Were there any particular kind of brand of conspiracy theory that really stood out to you as being harmful beyond just sort of people believing something different to the people around them?
Well, I took a good look at pseudo-law in the book, and I think people might be more familiar with the term sovereign citizen. You might have seen these clips circulating on the internet of people having these bizarre confrontations with police, you know, claiming that they're travelling, not driving when they've been pulled over at a traffic stop, making kind of legal-ish claims, but clearly incorrect claims. So, you know, a lot of people, again, think that's a completely American thing that's been imported here, but Australia has actually a really long history of its own forms of pseudo-law all through, like, the colonial legal system and up until the current day. And I have looked at the impact this is having on the family court in particular. There is, like, quite an unfortunate trend of these ideas being used in the family court, really disrupting procedures, slowing down the court system, and of course for families having a really detrimental effect when, say, one partner is trying to use these claims in court, the other is struggling with how to deal with that. It just creates a whole lot of pain. And I think talking to people that have tried to use these ideas in court, you know, the stories are really sad about why they've turned to this, but it again just has so much a ripple effect through the entire legal system, and of course doesn't end well, because at the end of the day these are not legitimate legal arguments.
Ariel, thanks so much for joining me. Ariel Bogle is the co-author of Conspiracy Nation, exposing the dangerous world of Australian conspiracy theories. Next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, ahead of that awkward Christmas lunch, how do you navigate difficult conversations with family without it turning into a huge argument? Well, we have been talking today about all areas of extremist thinking, and the holidays are often a time when we encounter some interesting views. If you're about to catch up with some friends or family that you haven't seen for a while, you might find they want to engage in a dinner table debate. And sometimes you are just not in the mood. You want to focus on your plate of snacks and having a good time, not getting into a huge political argument. So what does an expert say is the best and most constructive approach to disagreements? To help pinpoint some strategies, I'm joined by psychologist Christine Bagley-Jones. Christine, you say we need to counter us versus them thinking. What is that?
Tegan, it's a natural part of how humans operate. And in fact, we're wired this way for survival. Originally, it was a very simple way of identifying for our safety whether we were going to be with someone or not with someone, in terms of tribes and you know, just making sure that as we lived back then, we could get a little pack or a little tribe together. But as you know, now life is so much more complex. There's so many more factors that are influencing opinion. And what we're still doing is having that very dichotomous thinking in many settings.
So we're wired for this.
We're wired for this. And it's not a bad thing originally, and it still is for survival. It's a quick way of shortcutting to find out if someone is friend or foe.
It is interesting to sort of think about, if this is the way our brains are automatic and we can recognise that about ourselves, then we can take a step back and examine what might lie beneath that.
Yes, we can. And that's the key, not just having that knee-jerk reaction to, you know, that very binary, that person's good or bad, but realise that humans are complex and we don't need to have that very swift analysis, because there's more to us. And we can sort of zoom back and understand that we're more than our political views, we're more than our opinions on certain topics. We have a whole range that can be explored and identified with.
Okay, so if we have been like this for tens of thousands of years, why does it feel like we're more polarised now than we used to be?
I reckon there's a few factors. I think, firstly, the media. We have so much access. Never before in our lounge rooms are we saturated with so much information about what's going on globally. But in addition to that, we've got people's opinions being broadcast. So people are quick to make an assumption based on, or a preference or a belief system based often on someone that they might admire, that they might follow. They'll follow their lead rather than making their own conclusions. But separate from that, we are encouraged more and more to understand our values and what we stand for, and we're encouraged to speak up on those values. And thirdly, I think that the issues are very contentious right now. They are potentially very polarising, because they're big ticket items that people normally that might have sat on the sidelines will weigh in on.
I mean, we've always had conflict. We've always had war. There's always been divisions between humans. Like you say, we've been tribal in the past. You're saying that social media is a driver here?
I think it does definitely impact. And I think a lot of the etiquette has shifted also. I remember growing up and we had this blanket rule, no discussing religion or politics at the table. And I think that was in part around honouring certain boundaries where it was a safe zone, where it didn't necessarily be a landmine conversation that could just erupt. And these days, I think that we're giving permission to discuss at the family barbecue and the work lunchroom very hot topics, which can then be very divisive.
It is interesting to me that you're sort of saying that humans are hardwired to sort of have in-groups and out-groups. And previously that would have been your extended family and your community. But what we're now seeing is that people are often divided within families. Like the reason we're having this discussion is not because people far away from us think differently to us, but often someone at your dinner table thinks differently to us.
It's true. And I hear it all of the time with my clients. There's often, yeah, at the family gathering, some uncle said something that's very contentious, and it's becoming a big issue for people's mental health, because we need to have safe places and we need to have people that we can trust. And it's okay not to agree on everything. And I guess what we need to ensure is that bubble to some extent, because that's what's being penetrated now, that safe bubble where you can just let your hair down and know that you're going to be accepted and know that everyone's going to have differences, but it's not necessarily going to lead to estrangements or conflict.
I guess the through line from what I'm trying to ask you is, why can't we all just get along? So how do we get along when we are confronted with someone who's... I often feel like I'm going to take it personally if someone doesn't agree with me. How do I navigate that?
And I think that's so key, because we do take it personally. We take these big global issues, these broad topics, and personalize it. So we're actually offended. So what you can do in those situations is firstly, remember this actually is a global, everyone's experiencing the complexity and it's fraught. But also be curious yourself. Are you being that person that's not understanding someone else's perspective? Most of us all want the same thing. We want a happy life. We want peace. We want a future for children.
So if I'm anticipating a conversation like this with someone who I am going to spend time with, someone who I love, what's a way that I can prepare?
I think, firstly, be open-minded. And we don't want to be dogmatic. We don't want to ever be coming into any situation laden with judgment. Also, really want to understand their perspective and value the relationship as well. We can't die on every hill. So it's okay to stand really strong on certain topics, but you've got to also remember that you're going to be a very lonely and isolated person if you're alienating all of those around you. But also set some good boundaries and look at the timing and look at the topic and look at the person involved. You know, maybe don't get involved in a big heated discussion with Uncle Bob at a cousin's party if it's going to not go well, if you already know it's not going to go well. So have a couple of maybe one-liners in your pocket where if you feel it's getting a bit hot under the collar, you could say, you know what, we should probably leave this for now. Or, hey, I respect that our differences, we have different opinions here, so I think we should leave it for now, or this isn't the time. Look at the setting and the appropriateness of it. And just remember that you want to feel proud of yourself. So that's a balancing act between standing strong with your values, but also respecting the values of others, and also remembering the greater good of family and connection and that sense of belonging, which is so paramount to your mental health.
So that's at the individual relationship level, really important, really useful. Zooming out though, this idea of us being more fragmented, more polarized as a society, is there anything we can do as individuals to bridge that gap?
I think the best way to pursue that is try to look at the things we have in common rather than always focusing on the things that we don't have in common. Like I said earlier, we all mostly want the same thing. It's just the way we go about it sometimes is starkly different, and it can feel really offensive and really affronted. So try to, on a global level, realize that the human condition has a lot of commonalities and try to seek some comfort in knowing that we probably have a lot more in common than we consider. And the way we're going to move forward globally is through peaceful means, hopefully. And you being able to approach people that are different with different views with empathy, curiosity, patience, and try not to overjudge them. Keep to the facts, make sure the facts have been checked, and go about your business as peacefully as possible. Will probably be good for your cortisol levels and your sleep and your blood pressure and those around you.
Not arguing with strangers on the internet, a good place to start.
A very good place to start. And also that's the other thing, like have a break from it all, step away from it, do other wholesome activities with those that you care about, and dine on other information that actually is a feel-good experience, because we could just drown in all of the negativity that's going on globally right now. It's just on, it is on every front. It is in our community. It is in our nation. It's globally. And there are so many big topics. And if you don't take a break from that, it'll erode at your well-being, and then you'll stop being effective on every front anyway.
Psychologist Christine Bagley-Jones, thank you so much for joining me. That is just about it for Life Matters today, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Today's show was all about extremist beliefs, which may be something you encounter as you spend the holidays with friends or family that you haven't seen for a while or don't see very often. Tomorrow, we're going to be looking at inclusion and diversity in sport. But don't forget, you can catch up on any of the stories from today or any episode of Life Matters by going to the ABC Listen app. And I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.